and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
When the skies are a bright canary yellow, I forget every cloud I've ever seen. So they call me a cockeyed optimist, immature and incurably green. I have heard people rant and rave and bellow that we're done and we might as well be dead. But I'm only a cockeyed optimist, and I can't get it into my head. I hear the human race is falling on its face and hasn't very far to go. But every whippoorwill is selling me a bill and telling me it just ain't so. I could say life is just a bowl of jello and appear more intelligent and smart. But I'm stuck like a dope with a thing called hope, and I can't get it out of my heart. Not this heart. That song was first sung by the inimitable Mary Martin in South Pacific. I used to love listening to show tunes. My parents had lots of albums, and we went to lots of plays while I was growing up. But tonight I was looking for something positive, but not religious, for Easter season. I happened across a YouTube video, the beginning of South Pacific, with Mary Martin in it. Well, I was hooked. I'm not sure I've actually ever been called a cockeyed optimist. It's not a term that much of anybody uses. Cockeyed, crazy. Yeah, I've certainly been accused of being crazy, been accused of believing too much in people and in the future. But I don't mind, because I really do think that people, almost all people, are fundamentally good. I often disagree with what they do. Sometimes I abhor their actions. But it doesn't make me hate them. I believe in the power of love to change the world. And that's a fundamental part of my new American dream. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and I'm so glad you stopped by. I invite you to listen each and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's a listener-supported network, and any donations you make to them will go to support the many excellent shows that they stream around the world. And I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Sherwood Ross, Mickey Z, Phil Ferruccio, and Jim Fetzer. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Coral Gables, Madison, Port Orange, Queens, Astoria, New York City, and wherever you are. Well, I've got to mention, I've got a new book out, a new novel. It's called Revolution, and it's featured in Cold Type magazine, coldtype.net. The art is by Allison Healy. Another recent book is called American History 101. Allison Healy also did that art. You can find these books at CreateSpace, Amazon, and wherever there are ebooks. Coming in June, Operation Northwoods, the Patsy. All artwork done by Allison Healy and all published by CWG Press. Also, there are some books of mine on Smashwords. I want to mention a must-see, Jim Fetzer, the Boston Marathon Show Trial, the March 18th show. Go to radiofetzer.blogspot.com. And I want to mention Bill Pepper, William Pepper, on Black Op Radio. Len Osanek recently interviewed William Pepper, where Pepper says he thinks he is close to solving the RFK assassination, but now that he is getting close, Sirhan believes his life is threatened in prison, and if he dies, the case is over and the truth will never be known. This is an excerpt of the interview with Len Osanek. William Pepper, we are now very close to having an opportunity to open up this case. I think our position is very strong. My sense is that it's making powerful forces very nervous. We do believe we have access to information about how Bob Kennedy was killed, how it actually came about, how Sirhan was framed. Once that information comes forward, there will be no question of Sirhan's innocence, and the case will be wide open again. The assassination of Robert Kennedy foreclosed the possibility of very serious elements of truth and how we've come to be ruled. With that assassination, the death knell of democracy picked up speed, and we are rapidly becoming a corporate fascist society. That's what this struggle is all about, to try to keep a window open to the extent that we can, and to try to reveal the criminal acts of government and those people who run this government. We're not going to get it through mainstream media. We're not going to get it through the liberal media or progressive media, as they like to be called. And that's William Pepper on Black Op Radio. For the entire interview, go to blackopradio.com, show 723, March 19th, Dr. William Pepper. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. All we need is a 10 and a fiver, car and keys and a sober driver. B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run. We now join in progress another episode of the Wisconsin Daytime Drama Series, sponsored by the Wisconsin Arts Council, hoping you will contribute to their most recent fundraising attempt to get Blaze Orange and Camo the recognition they deserve on the state flag. And now we bring you Straight Outta Kenosha. We find Curly talking to Hal the bartender during happy hour at American Legion Post 99. Hal is just now refilling the green and gold plastic peanut bowl.
Another PBR, Hal.
You got it, Curly.
National Geographic Channel is running television specials on the Harley-Davidson factory and the Peterbilt truck plant, narrated in patriotic tones very much resembling the old Soviet-Russian domestic propaganda and Chinese people's films. In the U.S. television industry, these shows are categorized as educational, though their purpose is the same as the Reich's 1930s production, to attach the people's identity to the ingenuity and raw power of the American fatherland, to create pride in the accomplishments of the corporate state, and ultimately to perceive consumption as triumphal.
Uh-huh, said Hal.
And you know what else, Hal, me boy?
What's that, Curly?
One of the most unsettling things about this country is that the following people are considered perfectly sane by American standards. Dick Cheney, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Deepak Chopra, Bill Clinton, Oprah Winfrey, Pat Robertson, Grover Norquist, and Michelle Malkin. See anybody in that list even remotely normal? Every one of them lives an egomaniacal la-la land of his or her imagination and manages to get paid to do it. Believe me when I say just about any face you see on your television or in the newspaper is a nut job.
That's right, Curly. Adolf Eichmann was thoughtful, orderly, and unimaginative. He had a profound respect for system, for law, and order. He was obedient, loyal, a faithful officer of a great state. He served his government very well. The sanity of Eichmann is disturbing. We equate sanity with a sense of justice, with humaneness, with prudence, with the capacity to love and understand other people. We rely on the sane people of the world to preserve it from barbarism, madness, and destruction. And now it begins to dawn on us that it's precisely the sane ones who are the most dangerous ones. That's Thomas Merton in Raids on the Unspeakable.
Unfortunately, our national sanity is of the thoroughly dangerous sort, the Third Reich sort. Remember that even Adolf Eichmann was determined to be completely sane by a panel of medical experts. At least as sane as you and me. If you would like to be excluded from this comparison, you may be excused. Like the other good Nazis, old Ike would have easily made a respected member of American society today. Probably as a Republican judicial nominee. He would have fit quite well into a nation of Americans going about its daily business, caring for and protecting the homeland's security and profitability. Eichmann slept well at nights, the same as most of us, unaffected in appetite. He would have made a good carpooler, telling us all about the kids and grandkids as we commute the monotonous asphalt strips to and from our jobs. Creating the paperwork and the information product, the plastics and the commerce of the fatherland, that great sprawling circuit board one sees from airplanes. Like Eichmann, we are efficient, productive, and most terribly of all, untroubled by guilt. Oblivious as gravestones. Sane. The politicians and generals and bureaucrats and soldiers who planned all of our modern wars were also sane. As are people like Colin Powell, Stormin Norman, and Tommy Franks, and those unnamed legions planning the next ones for us. No one seems particularly upset. Daily life in the U.S., as usual. Totalitarian state here? Oh, that's insane.
That's right, Curly. What no one seemed to notice was the ever-widening gap between the government and the people, and it became always wider. The whole process of its coming into being was above all diverting. It provided an excuse not to think for people who did not want to think anyway. Nazism gave us some dreadful, fundamental things to think about and kept us so busy with continuous changes and crises and so fascinated by the machinations of the national enemies without and within that we had no time to think about these dreadful things that were growing little by little all around us. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion regretted that unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. Each act is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble, but the one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds or thousands will join you never comes. That's the difficulty. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtime, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays, but the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying with the forms, has changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one transformed. You have accepted things you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things your father could never have imagined. That is Milton Meyer. They thought they were free, the Germans, 38-45.
Well, yeah, but I didn't know you could read. Anyway, few of us believe that it's ordinary folks who sell a nation into hell, cast it in infamy. In a democracy, the people supposedly cannot be the problem. Right now, some of the smartest people I know are more convinced that the problem is George W. Bush and the dysfunctional little Adams family he's created, or who created him. No one's quite certain about that. The problem being, of course, that they're a danger to human civilization and the planet. The fallacy, however, is believing they're more insane than the rest of us. Although a couple of them probably are. Not many healthy, well-adjusted people look at Karl Rove or Donald Rumsfeld without a small flinch of horror and pity. The kind of fear one has of snakes and kind of pity one has for people who appear congenitally deformed in character. Rather like the kid I knew in grade school that poured lighter fluid on baby birds and lit it. Now we know that such kids grow what such kids grow up to become. Yet a walk through an American suburb or one of our bland office campuses can throw a thinking person into a darker funk than Rummy or Carl Toad of Darkness Robe ever will. We should be far more worried about the good Germans with orderly lives who populate all those office complexes here in the suburbs of our nation's capital. They are designers at the defense company in our building who create control systems for fighter missiles, or the government-contracted psychologists in the building across the lawn who help write what are essentially military torture manuals and killing protocols. When and if America is ever hauled before the tribunal it is so richly earning with every Iraqi child mangled and every soul it ships to Egypt to be tortured in unspeakable ways, out of sight of the world, what will be my excuse? Will it be I needed the health insurance that came with the job? Will that be an acceptable answer before the world? Who among us is guilty and who is innocent? Is the person who makes the night goggles for the American sniper on a Baghdad rooftop guilty? Is the person who made Lindy England's CD player guilty? The one they played while leading those naked weeping men around on dog leashes and in hoods? What about American workers who make Kevlar vests? Are they saving lives? Are they enabling killers to do their work more safely? Who among us is guilty and who is innocent?
Join us next week for another Wisconsin daytime drama straight out of Kenosha, sponsored by Cheesehead Earbuds, Beverly's Big Bratwurst, and Lake Wasoda Mulch Beer. Our first guest of the evening is Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer speaks to us from Madison, Wisconsin. Chuck will get Jim's interview lined up here. And Jim is a leading researcher. He's a former professor
Mike,
at
Chuck, it's great to be on with you again. I want to give you some update on the Boston show trial, which, of course, as you know, involved the defense attorney, Judy Clark, announcing that Zokar had done it when we have a mountain of proof that he had nothing at all to do with it, including, of course, the video footage of the police on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill! This is a drill!" The tweets from the Boston Globe, no less, stating that a controlled demolition will be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. And another stating that in 1 minute, an explosion will be set off opposite the library. And 1 minute later, an explosion is set off opposite the Boston Public Library. We have plenty of photos and videos showing that after one of the demolitions has taken place. Amidst all the smoke, there are bodies lying on the ground, but there is no blood. Now, Lorraine Day, who was for 35 years a chief of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital, has observed that would be impossible if this were a real event. In fact, the blood only shows up later, and it's not real blood. It's Hollywood blood. It came out of tubes, some of which remained in the debris as the site was cleaned up. We have Nathan Foulkes, Hollywood producer-director, observing one of the key players was an actor he'd cast in one of his own films, Carlos Abadero, who's wearing a cowboy hat and in some footage is seen standing at the sidelines waiting for his time to come in to the scene in accordance with a script. He rushes alongside the person alleged to be Jeff Bauman in a wheelchair, where if you had watched closely in previous photos and footage, a fellow in a hoodie was assisting in attaching a false prosthesis with a bone extension to make it look more horrifying. When they're rushing away in the wheelchair, the vibrations cause the prosthesis to fall off and they have to stop and reattach it. Or Nathan has observed what's taking place is known as hyper-realistic filming, where you create a setting as realistic as possible for the benefit, for example, of giving inexperienced soldiers some sense of what they may encounter in combat. Now, that was reported in one of my first articles on the trial as it began, which is entitled Boston Show Trial Attorney Declares Patsy Guilty, because we have ample proof he was not guilty. In a second article, I discussed the alleged confession that is introduced, which includes footage showing them capturing Zokar in a boat. There's quite a lot of rounds fired and several explosions in the footage, which came from Russia Today, where it's entirely possible that Zokar was in fact killed by those explosions. In any case, the prosecution has now introduced his bloody confession, which is was purportedly written on the inside of the boat while he was under siege and hiding out. And it was striking to me how the sentences were perfectly straight and evenly spaced. I mean, this is like a very properly formatted paragraph. And yet it's written on the curved surface of the inside of a fiberglass boat. When I looked into the matter, I discovered that you could only write on fiberglass if you had a special writing implement. Does anyone think that Zokar had a special writing implement for the inside of a fiberglass boat just by the sheerest of coincidence? And as I observed, not even one of our greatest artists and scientific figures of all time, Leonardo da Vinci, who is famous for his backward writing that could only be read using a mirror, could not have replicated what Zokar is alleged to have done. This is such a monstrous form of deception, I can't believe. And you can find it again in my article, The Boston Show Trial, The Bloody Confession of Zokar Sarnoff. Now, I also did an overview article about the New York Times, because it's publishing so much rubbish here, entitled The New York Times, All the Lies They Can Fit in Print, where you'll find an entire review of the case, and where the during the trial, they're introducing any number of these actors who were participants in this, none of whom actually died. And where Lorraine Day raises the question, since you can only see 10 or 15 people in the scene at the time, where are the other 200 supposed to be? Because the reports have now exaggerated the figure to 260 who are dead. Three were supposed to have been killed. And if you have read about the conclusion of the prosecution, they showed grisly photographs of a little boy who'd been blown to pieces. And I have no doubt those were bona fide photographs of a little boy who was blown to pieces. But it didn't happen at the Boston bombing. It may have happened at Gaza. It may have happened somewhere else. If you're in the shopping for them, you can find lots of photographs of children who have suffered ghastly deaths. So for the emotional impact, just as they had him being, you know, the false bone extension, they ran that past the jurors, where the emotionality of the situation is supposed to distract them from the absence of any actual bona fide proof. And where I now recently interviewed an attorney whose name is John Remington Graham. He has been a prosecutor. He's been a defense attorney. He's been a professor of law. And I asked him to review the evidence in the case. And Jack, as he prefers to be called, reduced it to its essentials by looking at several photographs of the young men wearing backpacks and talked about the dimensions and weight of a pressure cooker, for which I can vouch. My wife often does cooking using a pressure cooker. She's going to make a pot roast, for example. And it's very heavy, and it's awkward. And he observes that there are no signs that in either of their backpacks is anything of the size and dimensions, much less the weight, of a pressure cooker. And we actually include in the article a photograph of a pressure cooker, so you can see its dimensions, that came from an ABC special about report about the trial. But he also observes that these backpacks are the wrong color. And Zoker's, for example, is kind of gray or silver gray. But where, as he observes, according to the indictment, both of the backpacks that exploded were very similar in color, style, and design. They were black backpacks that had a white square on them, which just happens to correspond to the black backpacks we find on the craft personnel on the scene, where the alternative media had essentially cracked the case already the evening of the event by observing that two of these guys, for example, was moving toward one of the locations where one of the bombs would explode. And we actually show you the exploded backpack in the article, and then rushing away without their backpack. Jack didn't feel necessary to go that far, but only to show that neither of the backpacks that the boys were wearing were black with a white square, nor did they appear to contain any pressure cooker bomb, which means, in his opinion, that there was no probable cause for the arrest of Zokar, among other points. And whereas I have observed, his older brother Tamerlan was apprehended and taken into police custody after he was stripped bare. I could identify him, but his mother and his aunt both identified him. And the next thing we know, we have this dead body in terrible condition, and a witness who claims that the police ran over him three or four times with an SUV, probably his own vehicle, which is rather startling. I mean, just stop and think about it. The man is arrested. He's taken into...
Thanks, Jim Fetzer, for being with us, and we'll talk to you next time.
And now for another episode of The Adventures of Matt Splatt, big-time American Bigfoot TV researcher, sponsored by Black Flag Propane Neighborhood Mosquito Foggers and Itchy and Scratchy Mosquito Bite Patches. We see, barely, Matt Splatt sitting in the woods slapping mosquitoes. His face is one big red swollen bite. He is quiet as he itches and watches, squatting in the itchy brush. He wears his camo full-face stocking cap and camo socks and underwear, courtesy of the network. Strapped to his camo vest, he has his walkie-talkies, GPS, audio recorder, FLIR. He has a trail camera strapped to his back. The trees around him are bathed in peanut butter, Skippy. Matt Splatt is wearing his new parabolic supersonic bionic ears. Inside the many pockets of his camo vest, he has tweezers and Ziploc bags for sterile evidence collection and 900 extra AAA batteries, lithium. He has plaster for casting footprints and special plastic bags for feces collection. He has custom-made jam block knockers and has lots of time to think because the crew often leaves him, sometimes for a whole season in the woods. He wants the truth, wants to do primary research firsthand. Oh, to be a fly on the wall of a Bigfoot family cave, or the Dallas Police Chief's office on November 22, 1963, or Dick Cheney's bunker on 9/11, or today's NSA, CIA, FBI, on the days when they put on the Boston bombing and Sandy Hook. He wants to know. He needs to know. Do you know? I think there's a Squatch in these woods.
Yes. Matt Splat sits there and sees all these things. Bigfoot, alien landings, Bigfoot games of tag, alien picnics. Everything. They all walk past, eventually just feet away on the path. He has seen H. Wayne Carver and Gene Rosen and Carlos Arredondo and Robbie Parker. Matt Splat has watched Larry Silverstein poop and Rudy Giuliani sing Freebird, along with Barbara Olson and Osama bin Laden back in the day. One bright Tuesday morning, he sat there observing Timothy McVeigh and Muhammad Atta picking blueberries in silence like monks and then moving along. He doesn't say anything. He can't. If he actually finds anything, the show will be over. The producers say they need creative tension to keep viewers interested and to keep getting the show renewed. So Matt Splat sits and scratches, remembering the words of Yogi Berra, "You can observe a lot by watching." Tune in next week for another episode of The Adventures of Matt Splat, Big Time TV Bigfoot Researcher, when we will see Matt sleeping in a tree and waking up to see Henry Kissinger and Dick Cheney, John Stewart, Rachel Maddow, Brian Williams, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Anderson Cooper, Colin Powell, and George W. Bush walking by hand in hand and humming the Barney song.
And now an announcement that four Hy-Vee produce managers, two dental hygienists, one house painter, and three personal shoppers have been waiting for quite some time. Dr. Seuss's new book, winner of the Caldecott Award and the Newbery Prize, has also been awarded the New American Dream Total Nonsense Medal. The new Seuss book, the winner of the New American Dream Total Nonsense Medal, is The White House, the Black Cat, and the Black Hat, Sandy Hook, the Government Fairy Tale. Also nominated were Gene Rosen and the Sorcerer's Stone, Green Eggs and Ham and Gene Rosen, Gene Rosen of Green Gables, and The House at Gene Rosen's Corner. And winning honorary mention, oh, the places you'll go, Gene Rosen, Leavenworth, Lewisburg, Terre Haute, Attica, Florence, and San Quentin. And now for another episode of John Jones, a real reporter, works for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, is interested in baseball, NASCAR, lawn seed, city council, and conspiracies, OKC, 9/11, Sandy Hook, Boston, all of them. He worked in news for a while, now covers high school sports. He works on the conspiracy news when he has time. His editor says that whenever he gets something good, it will go in the paper front page and center. He wants to tell the truth like any real reporter, whether it costs him, his family, his life. Because good journalism is why he got into this, and it's more important than any... Nah, this is no use. Can't make this up. He doesn't really exist. Well, let's see what's on TV this week. This week on Inside Jobs with Mike Rowe, we'll look into multiple bombs found inside the Murrah building, the murder of Officer Terry Yeeke, and the ATF officers in the building being told not to come to work that day. And make sure to watch, Are You Smarter Than a Prison Guard? And be sure to cast your vote for The Next American Idiot. And be sure to watch this week on Last Tango with the Stars, The Dancing Israelis. You know them from the hit made-for-TV movie 9/11. The Dancing Israelis will be facing off with the Sandy Hook crisis actors and the 9/11 Harley guy in a wacky CBS nightly newscast. And now entering its 12th season, who knew it would last this long, In Chains in Guantanamo for No Good Reason, with your host, Jeff Probst. stay tuned for this week's news programming on the Fake News Network. Here's Morgan Anderson Cooper, Wolf Blitzer, Katie Kirk, Brian Williams, Matt Lauer. We know, it's torture. It's the Fake News Network. And now, we bring you the George Carlin, Bill Hicks, Lenny Bruce, Tarjay and Walmart Easter card collection, the card designed with you in mind. Some sample selections from the George Carlin, Bill Hicks, Lenny Bruce, Tarjay and Walmart Easter card collection. Bill Hicks. I was over in Australia during Easter last year, which was interesting. Interesting to note they celebrate Easter the same way we do, commemorating the death and resurrection of Jesus by telling our children a giant bunny rabbit left chocolate eggs in the night. Now, I wonder why we're fucked up as a race. Anybody? Anybody got any clues out there? Where do you get this shit from, you know? Why those two things, you know? Why not goldfish left Lincoln logs in your sock drawer, you know? As long as we're making shit up, go hog wild. At least a goldfish with a Lincoln log on its back going across your floor to your sock drawer has a miraculous connotation to it. Mummy, I woke up today and there was a Lincoln log in me sock drawer. That's the story of Jesus.
Lenny Bruce. Every day, people are straying away from the church and going back to God. If Jesus had been killed 20 years ago, Catholic school children would be wearing little electric chairs around their necks instead of crosses. God damn the priests and the rabbis. God damn the popes and all their hypocrisy. What influence did they exert to save the lives of the Rosenbergs? Guilty or not? The Ten Commandments doesn't say thou shalt not kill. Sometimes.
George Carlin. I credit that 8 years of grammar school with nourishing me in a direction where I could trust myself and trust my instincts. They gave me the tools to reject my faith. They taught me to question and think for myself and to believe in my instincts to such an extent that I just said, this is a wonderful fairy tale they have going here, but it's not for me.
I'm sorry if any of you are Catholic. I'm not sorry if you're offended. I'm actually just sorry by the fact you're Catholic. Bill Hicks.
George Carlin, I've begun worshiping the sun for a number of reasons. First of all, unlike some other gods I could mention, I can see the sun. It's there for me every day, and the things it brings me are quite apparent all the time. Heat, light, food, a lovely day, there's no mystery. No one asks for money, I don't have to dress up, and there's no boring pageantry. And interestingly enough, I have found that prayers I offer to the sun and the prayers I formerly offered to God are all answered at about the same 50% rate. I have as much authority as the Pope. I just don't have as many people who believe it.
And again, a sample selection from George Carlin. When it comes to bullshit, big time, major league bullshit, you have to stand in awe of the all-time champion of false promises and exaggerated claims. Religion. No contest. No contest. Religion. Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day. And the invisible man is a specialist of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you. He loves you and he needs money. He always needs money. He's all-powerful, all-perfect, all-knowing, and all-wise. Somehow just can't handle money. Religion takes in billions of dollars. They pay no taxes, and they always need a little more. Now, you talk about a good bullshit story. Holy shit.
some sample selections from the George Carlin, Bill Hicks, Lenny Bruce, Tarjay and Walmart Easter card collection, a card designed with you in mind. Our next guest for the night is Sherwood Ross. Chicago-born Sherwood Ross grew up in Miami, Florida. His father, an immigrant from Russia, was a wholesale liquor salesman, and his mother taught elementary school. Ross attended the University of Miami on a varsity debate team scholarship, where he majored in race relations, and during his senior year, earned money writing the weekly Vagabond 15-minute poetry show every Friday night on WTVJ-TV. At the same time, he worked as a reporter for the Miami Herald and wrote humor for its Fun in Florida magazine. His comedy, The Peacemonger, was produced in the University of Miami Student Box Theater in 1952. After graduation in 1955, Ross worked as a reporter for the City News Bureau of Chicago and then the Chicago Daily News, as a speechwriter for Mayor Richard J. Daley of Chicago, as PR director for the Chicago Urban League, until promoted to news director of the National Urban League in New York. There he wrote Whitney M. Young's speeches and ghosted Young's column, To Be Equal, that appeared in the New York Telegram and Sun and 50 other newspapers around the country. Ross served as James Meredith's press coordinator when he marched into Mississippi in 1966 and got Meredith to the hospital when he was shot. The next day, Ross appeared on the Today Show and called for concerned Americans to join him to finish the march. Thousands came, including the Reverend Martin Luther King, who praised Ross in public for all the wonderful things you have done for the Negro people. Book on the Meredith March to appear soon, containing information on how to hear all Ross tapes made for WOL of ML, King, and other leaders on the march. A professional publicist operating from his office in the National Press Building in Washington for 15 years, Ross read the editorial content of national magazines ahead of publication and wrote news releases for the publishers, which he distributed personally to hundreds of reporters in Washington, New York, and London, cities where he had offices. His clients included the Atlantic Monthly, the New Yorker, Harper's, Playboy, Penthouse, Psychology Today, Ms. Inc., Ebony, Essence, Harvard Business Review, Business Week, Harvard Magazine, Barron's, and nearly 100 other titles. His work, Publicizing the Education of David Stockman for the Atlantic, created a national sensation and boosted sales of the magazine by 100,000 copies. William Dickinson of the Washington Post Syndicate called Ross the best media consultant in the business.
Don't I wish that were true? Wouldn't it be nice to be the best of whatever you do?
Wouldn't it indeed? Welcome to the show, Sherwood.
Thank you so much, Chuck. When Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu visited here, he told Congress that Iran plays a pretty good game of hide and cheat with the international arms inspectors from the UN. He had this golden opportunity to tell the American Congress precisely how Iran was cheating, how it was concealing its alleged nuclear war-making facilities. He declined to do so. He didn't offer a shred of evidence. You wonder why Mr. Netanyahu didn't let his pals in Congress and the American public in on the secret. Everybody was looking at him. You know, if anyone is playing a game of hide and cheat with the inspectors, maybe it's Mr. Netanyahu who does not allow them to enter Israel and to inspect Israel's nuclear facilities. All the other countries with atomic bombs have to do so, but not the Israelis. And Israel is reported to have between 80 and 300 atomic bombs, depending on what you read. Iran lets the UN inspectors in all the time, but these nuclear inspectors can't get into Israel. Fancy that. In fact, the Israelis have imprisoned one of their own reporters for writing a book about Israel's nuclear activities. And Israel politicians like to claim Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Well, if it's a democracy, it's one without freedom of the press. you know, while Netanyahu shows no respect for the work of the UN investigators, maybe it's because they tell the truth, that Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon and is not making one. In fact, the former director general of the International Atomic Agency, Energy Agency, said in a published report that he had not seen, quote, a shred of evidence. Remember that phrase, a shred of evidence, that Iran was building nuclear weapons facilities or using enriched materials. That man was Mohammed El-Baradei, the Nobel Peace Prize recipient who spent 12 years at the IAEA. He told investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, I don't believe Iran is a clear and present danger. All I see is the hype about the threat posed by Iran. I don't see a shred of evidence that Iran is building nuclear weapons facilities and using enriched materials, end quote. Hersh points out that the last two United States national intelligence estimates, and this is from all the UN intelligence agencies, their estimates on Iranian nuclear progress have conclusive evidence that Iran has made no effort to build the bomb since 2003. Well, if you don't believe the Iranians, how about believing the American intelligence establishment? If the Iranians wanted a nuclear bomb, they might do anything to get it. That's what Netanyahu is saying, isn't he? They'd hide their facilities. Netanyahu brands the Iranians as reckless people, irresponsible enough to use the bomb against Israel if they got one. But which country, Israel or Iran, acts in a dishonest manner? Which country has a stooge sitting tonight in an American prison at this moment for passing nuclear secrets to Israel? No, it's not Iran. It's Israel. This miscreant's name is Jonathan J. Pollard. He's pleaded guilty in 1987 to selling classified information to Israel while working as a civilian intelligence analyst, and he got a life sentence. According to Wikipedia, the Israeli government at the time issued a formal apology to the U.S. for its role in Pollard's espionage. Its role, you got that. The Israelis admitted their role in Pollard's espionage. So sorry, right? So sorry. Yes, the Israelis were so sorry when the U.S. and major European powers entered negotiations to curtail Iran's nuclear program. The Israelis spied on the closed-door talks. This latest outrage was reported by Wall Street Journal reporter Adam Entus, March 23rd, a few days ago. In his words, the spying operation was part of a broader campaign by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to penetrate the negotiations and then help build the case against the emerging terms of the deal. A senior U.S. official briefed on the spying told the press, it's one thing for the U.S. and Israel to spy on each other. It's another thing for Israel to steal U.S. secrets and play them back to U.S. legislators to undermine U.S. diplomacy. I ask you, can you imagine the explosion in Congress if the Iranians were eavesdropping on those talks? In some, the Israelis built an atomic arsenal behind the backs of the United Nations. They stole American nuclear secrets. They spy on private American telephone conversations and they've got a prime minister sitting on 300 nuclear bombs screaming that Iran is threatening the world by building one atomic bomb for which he presents zero evidence and for which a head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says there is no evidence. Well, I leave it to you. Americans hear a lot about Iran that is negative, but maybe they're getting misinformation. So the United States is sending spies into Iran who are looking around to find traces of military nuclear development, according to reporter Hirsch. Here are some of the tricks the Americans are using to expose Iran's secret nuclear program, and they can't find anything. What they're doing surreptitiously, they're removing street signs and replacing them with signs containing radiation sensors. They're removing bricks from buildings suspected of containing nuclear enrichment activities and replacing them with bricks embedded with radiation monitoring devices. They're spreading high-powered sensors disguised as stones randomly along roadways where a suspected underground weapons site was under construction. And you know what they've got? Well, they haven't told anybody anything. And maybe that's because they're like Mr. Netanyahu, who doesn't tell the world anything about how he knows Iran is good at hide and cheat. Well, all of this should make us reflect that Iranian leaders and their chief, Ayatollah, has himself denounced the building of an atomic bomb. It's like he's told the Iranian people Iran is never going to do it. Why would he lie to them? Well, if Iran ever came to the point where it was in a war with the United States or Israel, it would lose. Iran has got a tiny $6 billion military budget. You know what Israel has? A lot of it coming from America. It has a military budget of $23 billion a year. And in case Iran wanted to attack the United States, America's military budget is $600 billion. So the Iranians are being spent by the United States by 100 to 1. You think that they're going to start a war with Israel? They'd have to be crazy. I'm sure
we're not. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we'll talk to you again next month.
Good night to every one of you.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida, with stops at Information Clearinghouse, Dandelion Salad, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and many others, here is Phil Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Apache helicopter and Hellfire missile blues, guys. You know, investigative reporter Chris Woods wrote that since August of last year, there have been more than 2,900 missile strikes by manned and unmanned aircraft, mostly perpetrated by our country. Now, to those out there who do not do the research, the Hellfire missile systems bought by you and me, tax dollars, cost us more than $4 billion for the Predator MQ-1C Gray Eagle and $11.79 billion for the MQ-9 Reaper. Those are great names, aren't they? Countless unarmed children, women, and the elderly have been blown away through the infamous collateral damage of these attacks. Who cares? Can that be what helped the crazies running ISIL to recruit more and more fighters? Or can it also be that the fact that one of the world's most terrorist states, beside, of course, us, is Israel, who got $3.1 billion a year in military aid from Uncle Sam last year? Actually, more than $120 billion total since 1949. Now, getting back to the Hellfire missile that our drones and those of our allies, the Brits, are firing down into the Middle East, they cost you and me 60 to 70,000 a missile. Multiply that by a few thousand and see the price. That seems like peanuts when we spend more than $50 million for one Boeing Apache helicopter. And the vehicle of choice for our soldiers on the ground occupying Iraq and Afghanistan is the unarmed Humvee. Now, here is the fact on that one. Regular Humvees cost, we taxpayers, $65,000 each. However, to protect the personnel better, like maybe they shouldn't be in those places in the first place, they up-armor the vehicle at a cost of $140,000 each. Okay, the conundrum is that the armored Humvees only last half as long as the regular ones. That is, they are not destroyed if they're not destroyed by IEDs or rolled over. Now, each year, more than 50 of our soldiers are killed and 100 are wounded by those two heavy, up-armored Humvees rolling over. Do the math and see how much is spent of our tax dollars for that mess, and tell the families of those dead kids that explanation. Now, this writer has focused, as you know, for years on the waste of our needed tax dollars for military spending, regardless of who occupies the White House or controls the Congress. Imagine if we did not spend more than 50% of federal tax dollars collected on a military-industrial empire. Imagine if even we cut that figure to 25%. That would be translated to $160 billion a year for repairing our nation's infrastructure, healthcare mess, transportation systems, school and library budgets, first provider budgets, et cetera, et cetera. So how about this? What if we use some of that money to buy most of that bad mortgage paper and help the homeowners on the water to stay in those homes with restructured government mortgages? Or how about if Uncle Sam used a couple of tens of billions of dollars to help local communities own and operate their own mortgage banks, charging only a half a point above overhead? We have many more owners and fewer renters to those predator rental housing megaliths. If only this writer loves that opening to that stupid commercial. Listen up, America. You think many out there would finally listen up, see the light, and demand the needed cuts in our empire's obscene military spending and foreign policies? I think they should. Happy Easter.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polishek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard.
And this, an excerpt from The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty by the Institute for Policy Studies. Being poor in a hostile nation, poor people, especially people of color, face a far greater risk of being fined, arrested, and even incarcerated for minor offenses than other Americans. A broken taillight, an unpaid parking ticket, a minor drug offense, sitting on a sidewalk, or sleeping in a park can all result in jail time. In this report, we seek to understand the multifaceted growing phenomenon of the criminalization of poverty. In many ways, this phenomenon is not new. The introduction of public assistance programs gave rise to prejudices against beneficiaries and a systemic effort to obstruct access to the assistance. As University of California Irvine Professor Karen Gustafson has noted, the intersection of race, income, and gender bias were at play in the 1960s-70s as black single mothers were targeted as criminal, lazy, promiscuous welfare cheats. The 1980s saw this demographic become the emblem of all that is wrong with government assistance for the poor. The infamous welfare queen. Black single mothers were fictionalized as criminally defrauding the taxpayer, taking in public assistance while driving Cadillacs, eating bonbons, and presumably getting rich off drug-dealing boyfriends. Thus, the 1990s brought aggressive state attacks on welfare recipients as they were increasingly investigated for fraud and other suspected criminal activities. The welfare system became a system of criminalization and punishment rather than a program to assist needy families. So-called welfare reform, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1966, ended federal cash aid programs and replaced them with time-limited restrictive state block grants. New punishable behaviors were mandated and policed, all but erasing the already tenuous line between the welfare and criminal justice systems. Today, when applying for welfare in the United States, many applicants are photographed, fingerprinted, drug-tested, interrogated, and asked to prove paternity of children. Similarly, eligibility for public housing is restricted or denied if the applicant has a criminal record, including misdemeanors or a prior lease violation. Further, local public housing authorities can be even more restrictive and evict occupants if a member of their family or another person residing in, or in some cases visiting, commits a crime such as a misdemeanor or drug offense. Poverty, in other words, is too often treated as a criminal offense.
That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table, and you can start the revolution today when you make direct eye contact when you pass a policeman. Our next guest of the evening is Mickey Z. And Chuck, go ahead with that whenever you want. I'll read here. Mickey Zesma was born and raised in Astoria, Queens, has
it's
appeared in
April
a book.
April with- already, and that means we get one of our favorite guests, Mickey Z from Astoria, which is part of New York City. Mickey, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chuck. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
So I keep reading about more cold weather up there.
I knew you were going to ask. It's cold and damp. It's been a long winter. It feels like a long winter in New York, and it's holding on into the spring. It's not giving up easily. So we're just waiting impatiently up here for weather to get back on the streets and do more activism.
Well, the weather will cooperate. So you mentioned that you're working on a new book. Can you tell us a little about that?
Absolutely. My next book, which will be published by Sullivan Street Press, is called Occupy These Photos, following up on Occupy This Book, which was sort of a personal discussion of activism. Occupy These Photos is exactly what the title would sound like. It's a collection of images that I've taken at New York City protests, and it covers sort of the last three and a half years, from the early days of Occupy at Zuccotti Park up till very recently with Black Lives Matter and with a bunch of other issues and movements included in between. And it's a book that's born on the streets of, you know, me being on the streets with my camera. And we're funding the book in sort of a DIY way, where we're doing the crowdfunding to get the book out there. So anyone that does follow me on any of the social media, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, WordPress, et cetera, or just Google Mickey Z, you'll be able to find the crowdfunding information and a little slideshow about the book called Occupy These Photos. And I'd certainly appreciate anyone who wants to help out, whether that be make a donation or just spread the word on social media and let people know this book is happening and they could be a part of it.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I know I have seen some of your photography that you've posted online in various places, and I've been very impressed. So it's really cool that you're putting together a book about a photo.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way, and I say that not in a a bragging way in almost like a astonished way, because as you know, I identify as a writer. You published one of my books. I mean, that's kind of what brought me into notice in the on the radical left, and then that combined with doing public speaking. But about 5 years ago, someone gave me a small digital camera as a gift, and I always wanted to do photography. I just really couldn't afford to get started. And then with this little pocket Sony, I started just taking it with me everywhere I went. And then before you know it, Occupy started, and I was, without really consciously thinking I was doing it, I was documenting the scope, the arc of a movement. And then someone within Occupy, a friend of mine that I met within the movement, a fellow vegan, in fact, she's a photographer, and she got herself a new camera, and she passed down to me her now unneeded camera, which was more of a high-tech type of camera. And so now I have the little guy and the one that this my other friend gave me, and I was so happy that people were kind enough to give me cameras, and I've kind of almost by accident become a photographer. And one of my favorite moments is when someone online, social media or elsewhere, identifies me as a photographer and then is surprised to find out that I quote unquote also write. So this book is a lot of fun in that sense, because, you know, we live in an increasingly visual culture, and people maybe in some ways will relate more so or be inspired more so by images. So I'm happy that I can be more multimedia, and I'm happy that Sullivan Street Press has decided to publish this. And I hope that folks will look for the crowdfunding page and get involved.
Well, absolutely. That sounds really good. Will it be a bigger format book than something?
What's interesting is, and it's a good question, because the primary focus initially of the book is going to be as an e-book, because Sullivan Street Press is sort of on the vanguard of digital publishing, and also the quality of the photos will be really, really intense on an e-book. And it seems to be that's how people are doing more and more reading. I could speak here in New York City, you ride the subways and so on, you see way more people reading books on devices, whatever different iPads, tablets, et cetera, then you see people holding physical books. Now, I happen to be a fan of physical books, but this is the trend it's going in. So it will be print. It will be bigger than Occupy, you know, bigger format, as you assumed. So you will be able to order it print on demand if you like. But for the newer wave of readers, we're aiming to do the ebook. So and people who do choose to donate to the crowdfunding, depending on how much money you're able to give, there are all sorts of payoffs back, which include a copy of the book, a print copy, an ebook copy, one of the photos as a poster, copies of Occupy This Book, and the list goes on. So we're trying to interact with readers and get them involved so that they're helping us out to get the book published, and we're giving them something back, which would be all these rewards. So I'm really curious to see what kind of response the book gets.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project, and I look forward to seeing that.
Absolutely.
A lot of weird stuff going on in the news lately. Anything jump out at you that you'd like to talk about?
Well, amidst all the spectacular news that you know, the news cycles that we're used to dealing with, we're beginning to see a lot of the posturing here in the U.S. That does take place the year before a presidential election. You see a lot of the suddenly, you know, for the past couple of years, all these politicians basically behaved the same and took donations from the same people and advanced the same policies, whether by name, whether those policies were called the same things or not, they were towards the same end. But as we get closer to an election year, all of a sudden the Democrats and the Republicans start to play this game where they want to differentiate themselves, so to speak, in the public eye. And you see them having these public disagreements and labeling each other and trying to prop up potential candidates. And so I feel like the as we head into April of 2015, the posturing is starting earlier than ever, and that the election cycle is basically on us. And every 4 years, I just keep hoping that the general public will become more and more aware of how we're being duped by this two-party farce. That remains to be seen. It seems to be one of the most enduring myths in American politics, that there's this dynamic difference between the two parties, and that a lesser evil exists, and so on and so forth. But I'm already getting a sense of that in the news, where almost every issue that comes up is being framed in this two-party deception.
Well, I think that's quite accurate, and it's pretty disgusting the way that this two-party thing keeps on going. It's like the Eveready battery.
Yeah, I mean, people want desperately to believe that they live in a strongly democratic, free country, the home of the brave, and so on. It's understandable why you'd want to live in a place that you could feel pride about. So it's not easy for anyone in America to look themselves in the eye and say, I've been lied to, I fell for the lies, and they're continuing to lie to me. My country is not what I was taught it was. Those are very ugly truths. So the people selling those truths are playing on the fact that the average person that doesn't spend time doing radio shows like this and so on, really doesn't want to explore too closely the possibility that their country is responsible for incredible oppression and mass murder across the globe. So it comforts them to believe that they live in a country where the two parties are so uniquely different that they really have a genuine choice, and elections that, you know, that the average person plays such a big role in elections in this country. And so since there's so much at stake, they become more willing to be duped by these lobbyists and PR companies and corporate propaganda. But I think as more and more people, as I just said, the average age of a minimum wage worker in this country is 35. I mean, at some point, if you're 35 and you're making the minimum wage, you know, it's a good time to look at yourself and say, you know, is this really the land of opportunity? And, you know, that I was taught from the time I was old enough to understand the phrase. And that's kind of the little bit of a mission that I know I've taken on as a writer and as a public speaker, and now, as I said, as a photographer, just trying to provoke people to challenge these myths and really, really look at things with a critical eye, because as you know, these myths don't stand up to critical thinking. They don't stand up. You aim your magnifying glass at them, and the facade crumbles rather quickly. So every 4 years, it just seems more amplified than any other time, because we're being sold more and more lies over a presidential time period than any other time period. So I think this is the time where stuff like you're doing, this alternative media and so on, becomes absolutely more crucial, that we need to challenge the dominant narrative and come up with a different narrative and tell different stories and inspire new thoughts, because otherwise we're going to get the same twiddly-dee and twiddly-dumb in 2016 choice between Republicans and Democrats, whether it's Jeb Bush versus Hillary Clinton or any other two people that are on that higher level of politics. And at some point, you know, we're going to pass the breaking point. You know, you and I have spoken many times about the state of the ecosystem, and neither party is doing anything to stem that tide, and all these issues become moot if we don't have a functioning ecosystem. So I encourage people, if you care about the future, is to start rediscovering the subversive pleasure of thinking for yourself. And a great place to start would be American presidential elections, to realize how intensely we are being manipulated and lied to.
Well, that was a powerful statement, and I couldn't find any of it that I disagreed with. And we're over time, I think, but we'll try to fit it all in. And Mickey, I just want to thank you once again for being on our show, and talk to you next month.
All Thank you very much for giving me a platform to share my views. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure, Chuck.
All right. Thank you.
Good day. All right. Bye-bye.
Coming up next half hour, the news from Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown.
And now for tonight's Dick Tracy Crime Stoppers Bulletin. When you see something, say something. Because of the murder of journalists Michael Hastings, Gary Webb, Dorothy Kilgallen, Hunter S. Thompson, comedian Bill Hicks, Mary Pinchot Myers, David Ferry, Dallas Police Officer Roger Craig, Lee Bowers, Jack Ruby, Hale Boggs, Barry Jennings, and Paul Wellstone, a special bulletin has been released. Be on the lookout for FBI license plates in your neighborhood. When you see something, say something. Because of the murder of men, women, and children in Waco, Texas, be on the lookout for FBI license plates in your neighborhood. When you see something, say something. Because of the illegal torture, imprisonment, and false flag attacks designed to put the public in a state of panic in Guantanamo, Tucson, Aurora, Sandy Hook, Boston, and elsewhere around the country and globe, citizens are asked to be on the lookout for FBI license plates in your neighborhood, as well as a long black limousine with tiny American flags fluttering from the quarter panels. The persons inside the limousine are to be considered liars and murderers. This has been your weekly Dick Tracy Crime Stoppers Bulletin. When you see something, say something. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings. Like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops. And it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the gold. We continue our story. Fluff Dublin is driving through downtown Duluth while listening to the radio and also his recorder, hoping to hear the voice of Bigfoot. What he hears might not be what he expects to hear.
He's got a six shooter, a gun, a cigarette hanging. Fluff Dublin sang to himself as he drove in his father's 71 Blue Bonneville down Superior. Yeah, he's a cowboy kid. Fluff had his earbuds in and his recorder on the seat next to him. The radio was on. He could hear it a little. He liked to be doing as many things as possible at one time to make the best use of the day. Fluff could sing and listen to the radio and his recorder because all that was on the recorder was some static and nighttime wood sounds like wind and leaves and the occasional barn owl. He fast-forwarded when the loud train came through every hour. At the light, Fluff pumped. The frame squeaked, but the brakes were usually fine. He was on the level now. He did not want to have to turn left up the hill. He had to be aware at all times where he was with the Bonneville submarine. Too much downhill or uphill, things could go south in a hurry. He passed the bus terminal. Through the shadow of the valley of the tall buildings. Sometimes he mistook the ambient sound for sounds he had recorded. A fire engine blew its horn. Fluff thought it was a train until he looked in the rear view. He steered the Bonneville out of the way into a parking spot in front of the Acoustic Eel Bait and Music Shop. Fluff pushed his earbuds in tighter when he heard crunching noises. He could also hear the radio a little and the people on the street. A boat in the harbor blasted its horn. The Minnesota DNR Hunting and Fishing Report, brought to you by... The paper in the rack up next to the building asked passersby, why would Robert Lund kill Mary Pine anyway? Fluff heard voices. and pushed his earbuds in further. Frosty Pine, a senior at East High School, has been missing since. Cars rumbled by on the bricks. Fuff could make out different individuals in the voices, crunching leaves, a train in the background. Too loud? Now no voices. Shit. Fuff slapped the Bonneville ship captain wheel. Two people walking past looked at him, kept walking. The Minnesota bear season. Fuff tried to shut off the car. The engine shook. The whole thing shook like a dog after plowing through a creek. The voices were close now. He took his fingers out of his ears. He reached way over to the glove box and fished his cigarette. He rolled down the window, shoved in the lighter. A weather bomb. Another. This area. Soon. Possible. Hitler. A man stood on the sidewalk, facing Fuff in his shuddering, faded blue Bonneville. He wore leather pants and a leather vest, wide open, showing a pirate tattoo covering his chest and large stomach. Fuff looked at the man, but did not see him. The Minnesota muskie season. The man had a wooden leg, a peg leg. Maybe Fuff just imagined that. The UMD hockey squad. Please, please, no! A woman's voice. He blew smoke out the window. McNugget has been asked to testify. The wind took the smoke right into the man's face. He closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and smiled with closed mouth. He petted the parrot on his shoulder and leaned his little wooden cane against the parking meter, took off the red bandana around his head to retie it. Just kill him now. The former mayor has been sick in bed since the election, unable to shoot them, stab them all. No, please, please. Fuff watched the man walk off using the cane, limping on a peg leg, sticking his belly out, confidently moving down the street as if off to look up his favorite barber after a year at sea. He knew that voice. Fuff heard gurgling noises and thuds and gasps. He let the cigarette fall from his dangling hand under the bricks. He let his head fall back against the seat. He stared up at the red and green and yellow neon sign for the acoustic eel, flashing, strobing, the eel seeming to crawl. Fuff shivered. String him up! Fuff heard dragging, then a breeze, and then a train far away, coming closer. Sources say some of the missing were scheduled to testify to the Big Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Now we see Penny Jones and Fuff driving together to the woods. I can't get that out of my head, that commercial. Penny looked over at Fuff. They were driving in Penny's panel truck out to the place where Fuff had his recorder, where he heard the sounds. Arrowhead, chimney sweep, if you got the loot, we'll bag your soot. Please. Fuff leaned his head back, closed his eyes. He rolled the window down. It was people. On the recorder. Oh, said Penny. Okay. Fuff leaned over to tune the radio. He shoved back up. Penny looked at him and shook his head, then back to his driving. Fuff, said Penny. What? What the shit kind of a name is Fuff? Supposed to be Duff. My little nephew called me Fuff. All the family started saying it, calling me that. I just kept it. Fuff, right? It's unique, said Penny. makes you special. Fucking whatever, man. Penny turned onto a dirt road. How much farther, he said. Just keep going, like I said, I'll tell you. You got the power, said Penny. What? All power, said Penny. Where is it? I don't... Money, that's where. So how do we get power? Money. Money is freedom. You have to work. Do whatever anybody tells you. Even make you get up when they want you. Go to bed. Eat what you can afford. It's all money. Yeah, so get the money. Give me the money, like they say. That's all I'm saying. Buck sat up and rubbed his eyes with his fists. Okay, where's the money? What money? How? So, Penny said, what money, huh? You ever wondered about that? And where is it? And how would we get it? Work hard, said Buck. Get up early. Keep your head down. Penny looked over at Buck as if the seat had been empty moments before. No. He ran a stop sign at a dirt road four-way. You just, said Buff. That wouldn't get you freedom or power ever. Ever. Penny gripped the steering wheel with both hands. His face was red and the veins in his neck bulged. Buff could see Penny's jawbone like a T-Rex sitting down to eat the zookeepers. Listen, said Penny. Rush to work, rush home, on the highway, in the building, sit down, coffee, think, kids, home, food, car, church, relationships, everybody okay. What the hell are you talking about, man? Buff moved as close to his door as he could get. The look, Penny screamed. Buff looked all around. What? Where? Look. What? Penny pulled over to the side. Buff had known Penny for a while, but not long enough that he did not wonder if he would use the gun and knife on his hips or if he was some kind of prevert. In her eyes, Penny rested his forehead on the steering wheel with his hands at 10 and 2. Buff saw Penny's breathing, his grip on the wheel, the clenching of his jaw, the stocking cap down past his eyebrows. He kept the clutch in and his foot on the brake. The radio played at 3 volume. Penny sat back against the seat and turned his head to Buff. The look in her eyes. Just before I was going to kill her, just before she got shot. Buff looked out his window and mumbled something just softly enough that Penny would not shoot him and cut his dick off or his dick collection back under the Canal Street Bridge. Penny reached across the seat to grab Buff's bicep. Dude! Buff kept looking out the window, trying not to breathe, trying to be somewhere else. She knew. Penny let Buff go. She had the look of freedom. She knew where the money was. Buff looked over at Penny. Really? Really, said Penny. That's why they killed her. Did she tell you? Said Buff. They sat on the side of the road. The sound of some creek gurgled on both sides, coming in through both their open windows like regular surround sound. They had to. They had no choice. Yeah, but did she tell you, you know, man? Where is the money? Penny looked in his side view and took off. Fucking idiot. Buff heard him mumble as he threw up gravel. Buff pointed where to turn. Some people say Bigfoot sounds like people, said Penny. Not that I'm just saying. I know. But this, hey, turn here. puffs that up. He rolled the window up. This is it. He looked at Penny as Penny turned off the engine. You would have killed her? Penny stared at Puff in silence, his hand on the keys and the ignition. What money? Puff said. The gold. The gold, man. The gold.
That's the news from Duluth, Minnesota, where all the police and soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We're allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. There's no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be opened during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing United States politicians, journalists, and generals who have brought about this long 12-year war and debacle to trial. Put them on TV just like OJ every afternoon so every American can watch, just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream. Not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. Right now, we live on lies. We subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, Rumsfeld, Ashcroft, Obama, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, they all know that. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand, and we need to be allowed to ask questions. Our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. They are not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters. The ones who go face to face with the empire. Those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. He is complicit. He has lied. He's continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. He lied right to our faces on national television when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Osama bin Laden buried at sea, and Jessica Lynch was rescued heroically. The USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. See, there is a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. It went all the way into that hole. And, well, no, there's no blood, no bodies, no luggage scatter or plane parts. And Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters which said, "Are you afraid?" Those were not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government, like a horror movie. And the killer is in the same house with us. These killers are right here with us, and they want us to be afraid. We cannot be afraid. As we wrap up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show, I'd like to thank all of our guests. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mike Palachuk, and I would most especially like to thank you, our listeners. We appreciate you. We thank you for being here with us tonight, and we hope you'll be back each and every week, 6 to 8 p.m., streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And while I'm thanking people, let me thank freedomslips.com and Revolution Radio, because it's a great listener-supported network, and they have a very fine set of shows. Visit them at freedomslips.com. They have all sorts of gift packs, or just you can just make a donation to help keep all these shows on the air, because once again, it is listener supported radio, and that's why it's totally independent. Once again, thank you, Mike, and good night.
Thank you, Chuck. And I want to make a announcement, just let people know that next week our guests again will be once again Jim Fetzer, and we'll also have Richard Flamer speaking to us from Chiapas, the Catholic worker in Chiapas. We will again have Phil Ferruggio. We're lucky enough to have Phil Ferruggio every week on the New American Dream Radio Show, and we'll also have Susan Lindauer. And so, again, thanks to our guests tonight, Phil Ferruggio, Sherwood Ross, Mickey Z, and Jim Fetzer. Also, credit and thanks to Joe Badgett. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to the show.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artisan Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, with the real face of American history up there in stone, Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at loosefrock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrubyridge.com. To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave handy campfire rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-sized Obamaville Tom Jefferson rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And so good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Lamely Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Mohammed Atta, and good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.